We'll be glad to answer any questions, or we can just open up for discussion, because there are other people here who know a considerable amount.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the president of the German Association of Acupunct Energy, as you know. Dr. Puthoff pointed out a perfectly understandable way that the extraction of this energy is feasible. How? That's the second question. It's feasible. Now, there is a few other systems and mechanisms, apparently, by which this energy is extracted. Townsend Brown, etc. However, and this I want to point out, to my opinion, the ideal tool to extract this, harness this energy and render it in a practical form is the water molecule. The chemistry of water is two lives to fill, at least, if not more. It's absolutely fascinating what the water molecule can do. And it is apparent that not only we can dissociate hydrogen oxygen to Nell gas or hydrogen oxygen gas, which is difficult to control, but there are steps in between which I call the burnable water. For instance, you inject water into a jet plane, jet reactor. JP4 contains about 13% of water. The theory that for the weight and the mass of water, this propels the jet even better, this does not hold. It is apparent that in the fire, the water molecule is in itself converted into a burnable liquid. Any good fireman can tell you that when in a strong fire, he throws water, this pump, this tube, and his hoses. The water burns. It becomes a burning medium. I will show you tomorrow automobile technologies where, for instance, 50% of the fuel is water. 89% of the fuel is water, but not nail gas. Now, the point is that burnable water, which is apparently polarized water, which is not yet really dissociated, is much better controllable than is nail gas. And may if you dissociate 1 liter of water to become nail gas, do you say nail gas in English also, or hydrogen oxygen? K-N-E-L-L, nail gas. Hydrogen oxygen. It is about 52 kilowatt hours per liter of water, which is about 70% more than is for gasoline, 1 liter or 1 kilogram. If this is only polarized water, it may be half of that amount, but this is not the issue. Important is that it's well controllable. Now, what you will see tomorrow is how water is converted by relatively easy means in an electromagnetic field under ultrasonic conditions, under electrolyte conditions, various conditions, converted into a more or less burnable or ignitable medium. And when you can not only use this in automobiles, but you can also feed this to jets, and with these jets repair nuclear and fossil utilities, for instance. I wrote this to Prime Minister Stolpe of Berlin, Brandenburg, who has invited Rolls-Royce to build and BMW to build a jet plant there. And of course, you imagine how was his response. Well, he was most enthused about this idea to replace all utilities of today. Look, we do not need electrical energy more. I tell you as a doctor that the frequency smog and all this is a major, major health challenge. What we need is fuel as the ultimate form of energy to drive our existing technology. We can, for instance, with this burnable water, drive a turbine in a Volvo has a turbine in the car, then this turbine drives the electrical. I was with the Mazda last year. Mazda has, as you know, this rotary Wankel motor. This Wankel motor has the ability to absorb, to play with the high speed explosion, the high speed burning of hydrogen better than does the conventional piston motor. But the Wankel has difficulties to burn burnable water, whereas the turbine is more practical in this context. Now, if you ask me, I would focus, I promote this, mainly on the aspect to convert water into a burnable medium by this kind of energy. That's more practical. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned this, let's say, the hard use concept and so forth. This is so many things. Also the ML converter, which you'll see tomorrow, a brilliant masterpiece of an experimental model, but it's not adapted, it's not practical to drive these cars or heat these houses over there. But about the feasibility, there is no doubt. I gave a lecture on this in Düsseldorf about 5, 6, 7 years ago already, and came a man and said, "Oh, you're a hell of a guy. That's absolutely fantastic." I said, "What's you?" I said, "I'm the now retired vice president of the Ruhr Coal Authority in the Ruhr district in Germany, European authority already at that time." And he said, "You would of oil and out of coal if we had inexpensive energy." Same thing, yeah. And I also have not experienced any confrontation by energy plants or companies. Yes, from orthodox physicists or even not from that side. It's a new world. But there is absolutely no doubt about the conversibility of this kind of energy. How this be done is of a secondary importance. So I'm happy that with our efforts we can support this. The German Association of Vacuum Field Energy was founded in 1980 with this name. Not so bad, huh? Mm-hmm. Huh?
Early.
Early, yeah. Early birds find the worm. So thank you very much also for you coming here and coming then to Hanover.
I have one question. Can you explain what time is connection with this reference identity?
The timing?
Time. You know, time is almost like gravitation.
Is it a relativity?
I see.
Function. Is it an absolute?
Out of this work, you can generate all the aspects of Einsteinian general relativity, either directly or with some modifications. And so things like time dilation and time compression that occur in general relativity conditions also occur in models based on vacuum energy.
Yeah.
There's more description, I think, in the vacuum energy as to why those things occur. They are dependent on the density of the vacuum energy.
The quality of the ether energy, let's say this way, determines the speed of light, which is not considered, if you ask me.
In fact, it's been published in the physics literature that between Casimir plates, where you reduce the vacuum energy, the speed of light is faster than the usual value of C. So since we can use light bouncing back and forth as a clock, defines time, so time would run faster between Casimir plates.
If you change time, you change gravitation.
That's right. Yes. You go hand in hand.
Yes.
Right. And you change gravitational mass, inertial mass. There are theories published which can be understood in terms of vacuum energy, where conditions for generating what's called electrogravitic repulsion can occur. And there are papers in the physics literature with titles that have the terms electrogravitic repulsion. And under the conditions that are specified in those papers, inertial mass decreases, gravitational mass decreases, time runs fast, gravitational effects become less, so you can get all those kinds of distortions of space-time, as a general relativist would say, or distortions of the vacuum field energy, as a field theorist would say.
Dr. Apotov, is there an odd calculation about the hypothetical, or whatever, density of this field? First, or for the more or less traveling compartment, including tachyons, which may account for the shielding and gravitational effect. But the major portion seemingly is static in space, in situ, more or less static. And,
on the vacuum.
We leave an impression in space, apparently. So this stays there for 8 hours, so there must be little movement. And this, to my opinion, is a field density which is far beyond the traveling compartment, which accounts for gravitational acceleration or the respective shielding effect.
Well, the energy density associated with vacuum fluctuations has been calculated by many physicists like Wheeler, Feynman, and so on. And it's enormous. It's the equivalent of 10 to the 94th grams per cubic centimeter. Or 10 to the 107th joules per cubic centimeter.
How many joules?
10 to the 107th. I mean, it's enormous.
10 to the 94th power?
Right,
grams
per cubic centimeter equivalent. Originally, when that calculation was made, it was assumed that there was something wrong with quantum theory. It seemed like an artifact. But then as time went on, and we had to explain the Lamb shift, we had to explain the Casimir effect, we had to explain van der Waals chemical attractive forces, and all of these required taking the vacuum fluctuation energy seriously, and they all required that density was in fact the density. So as time has gone on, physicists have become accepting that the density is really that high. And so that's led Wheeler, for example, well-known American physicist who worked with Einstein for years, he said that all of the physics that we know and love are just perturbation ripples on the vast vacuums energy sea.
But this does not seem to be known by all professors. I talked to a professor in Germany, theoretical physicist, and he said, we know that there are some fluctuations in the vacuum field, but this amount of energy you are talking about, we don't believe in that. That's what he said.
Yes. The reason, unless you look into it in depth, many physicists don't particularly think about it, and when they first hear it, kind of dismiss it, is that this energy is very uniform, by and large. And all effects that are created by the vacuum energy are created by things that make differences. But by and large, it's very uniform. And so in almost every problem we solve in physics, since it's just a uniform background, you can subtract it out and ignore it and do your calculations as if it didn't exist. And so many physicists who are used to the sort of superficial level where you write it down, you see the energy density is there, and formally it's infinite. It's only when you get into gravitational theory you realize it's not infinite, it's only almost infinite. And then you subtract it out and you ignore it and then you go on. And so at a superficial level, many physicists never think about it and find it hard to believe. But anyone who's into calculating any kind of interaction associated with the vacuum field energy, they certainly recognize, and as I say, physicists like Wheeler, like Feynman, physicists who really know the depth of physics, recognize the energy is there. So the fact that some physicists sort of say, well, that sounds impossible or I don't believe it, of course you realize that most physicists are like cooks using recipe books. And they just use whatever recipes they're used to using to cook their particular dishes. And most of them don't really understand the depths of physics. And so it's only the physicists who delve into that depth who recognize that this is true. And so all the, you would say, top physicists whose names anyone would recognize absolutely accept the reality of the vacuum energy. Give you one example. When it was first thought that maybe it was a false idea, one of the questions that was required to take it seriously was simply if you excite hydrogen gas
and then you get emission from it, you can write Schrodinger's equation down, you can solve the equation, you can tell what the frequencies of the excited gas, light, ought to be. When you go in the laboratory and measure it, it's off by a gigahertz. And so it was Weisskopf and Willis Lamb who said, well, when we solve Schrodinger's equation, we solve it for an atom as if it were in a void. But it's not in a void, it's in this seething cauldron of vacuum energy. Let's go back and solve the equation again, this time taking into account that it's being jostled about. So sort of the difference of solving an equation about a ping pong ball sitting in a placid lake versus solving an equation for a ping pong ball sitting at the base of a waterfall. When they redid the calculation, they found that the effect of the vacuum energy was to shift the emission lines by a gigahertz. So now theory and experiment matched. Lamb got the Nobel Prize for this. And the only way you could explain the result was to take seriously that this energy existed and its density was this enormous density. So step by step, it went from being, it can't be true, to, and it must be an artifact, to, okay, we needed to explain the Lamb shift. The next defense was, okay, the energy is there, but it's not important. It only has microscopic changes in certain atomic phenomena. So even though it's really there, it's not important. Then as we went further, and I'll talk about in my presentation tomorrow, we suddenly realized that the only reason we see each other in this room is by spontaneous emission. We absorb photons from the sun, it excites atoms, the atoms drop down. Well, it turns out that spontaneous emission is not spontaneous. It's driven by the vacuum fluctuations. Spontaneous emission is when energy hits an atom, puts it into an excited state, and then it, quote, spontaneously falls back down and emits photons. Sort of like standing a pencil on its point and letting go, and the pencil will fall over. But it was finally realized that the pencil doesn't fall over on its own. It's actually pushed over by these fluctuations. And so then it was realized that you could control spontaneous emission, which was always thought to be a property of atoms. But you could take these atoms, put them in a special cavity, eliminate the vacuum fluctuation energy at the resonant frequency, and if that's what's causing spontaneous emission, then these atoms in these special cavities should not spontaneously emit. And so they built the cavities, they put the atoms in there, and they didn't spontaneously emit. And so in 1985, that was considered one of the great breakthroughs in experimental physics, was to prove you could actually control spontaneous emission rates. Now they've gotten it to where they can slow down spontaneous emission rates by factors of 40 or 50. They can increase spontaneous emission rates by factors of 500. And this is now such a mainstream concept that in the April 1993 Scientific American, which is a popular kind of article, they had an article on cavity quantum electrodynamics. And in there, they talk about the fact that atoms put in special cavities won't spontaneously emit because there are no vacuum fluctuations to stimulate that emission. And so suddenly it's gone from being not true to being true but irrelevant to now it controls the actual spontaneous emission, which is a major phenomena. And then, as we now know, even inertia, which is ubiquitous, is based on that. So it's moving from a peripheral concept to center stage. And I think that once devices are built which demonstrate the extraction of that energy, then it'll reach the level of being very real, even to those physicists who say they don't believe it. Doug. Call me Hal, please.
All right, Hal. One of my former associates, who knows Dr. Niebuhr quite well, was PhD out of Minnesota, Chinese born. Ended up as chief consultant to the U.S. government fusion physics, fusion not fusion physics, to Los Alamos, to Argonne National Lab, and to Lawrence Livermore. And when we ran by him a number of years ago, as Hans probably well remembers, the concept of shielding theory of gravity and some of the other concepts that have ultimately helped us understand better ZPE, zero-point energy, and so on, he dismissed this out of hand. He was rather arrogant about it. He said, I'm speaking to you. He dismissed it out of hand, saying, well, I've got to be polite to you guys, but he said, you know, gravity and all of these things, they're non-vectorial forces, so they can't exist. They can't be tapped. Forget it. And that was his dismiss. Now, that was a few years ago, but would you care to comment on that attitude among certain classical physicists?
The best example to counter is that T.D. Lee, another Chinese physicist, who got the Nobel Prize for parity violation, is absolutely committed to the idea that the vacuum is a medium and that it's an engineerable medium. And, in fact, one of my view graphs that I'll show at the conference tomorrow was a paper he wrote this year for the Boltzmann Centenary whatever. And the title of his paper is Vacuum as a Physical Medium.
Great. Thank
and
you.
So, the really good physicists.
Again, wrote a certain physics professor and director of the top research department of EMW, wrote to me, Dr. Nick, there's time for you. I heard of you. But the density of the vacuum field energy is so weak that it would never suffice to drive an EMW automobile.
Then I came about great. 4 weeks ago. Great. I'd like a copy of that too.
Again, I was very intrigued, fascinated by your idea. That's the description where the electron gets the energy from. When it gives off a signal or gives off energy, yes, it stays in orbit. Where does the energy come from?
It's that. All of the electrons and all of the atoms out the cosmological distances are all radiating the energy off. And therefore, any particular atom sees the radiation coming from all the other electrons in the universe. And that arrives and causes it to jiggle, and it emits its radiation. And so it's this giant feedback cycle.
Yeah, sure.
And what you can show, and I also published in Physical Review, was that if you look at the ordinary hydrogen atom, the little model that you see on a textbook cover that looks like the little solar system with the electron running around, the electron planet running around the proton sun, physicists have always worried about, well, why doesn't that electron in that circling orbit radiate its energy away? Yeah. And so even with the development of Schrodinger's equation and so on, that question was never answered. But once vacuum energy was understood to be real, you can then go back, and I did, and I made the calculation and published it in Physical Review D, to show that indeed the electron in its orbit does radiate its energy away, but if you calculate how much energy it absorbs from the vacuum fluctuations, there's one stable orbit, and it is the known Bohr ground state orbit. And so that can be extended. I'm working on a paper on that now. That can be extended to show that all quantum ground states are defined as the states in which the absorption and re-emission of vacuum energy is in equilibrium balance.
It seems to me then that the ZPE probably enters in as a chemist to practically every chemical interaction as well.
That's right. All the van der Waals forces have been shown to be vacuum energy forces.
Yeah, this is also we are confronted now in medicine. If you hear of transmutation, the thing is to explain this. A chicken gives off more calcium than it absorbs from the food. Where does the calcium come from? Mm-hmm. And this Caron, this was not again and again in scientific, but maybe in medicine. And this plays a major role in science.
Well, it suggests transmutation of elements.
Yeah.
And similarly, in the cold fusion work. One of the really outstanding experiments that I know of from
Cal Poly by Bush and Eagleton, they noticed that there was transmutation in the cold fusion experiments. And in one of the steps, strontium was created out of an initial medium in which there was no strontium. And so the criticism was, well, it's just contamination strontium. But it's known that the contamination strontium is a certain isotope. But when they did these experiments and got strontium as a transmutation element, it turned out to be a different isotope than any of the contaminant isotopes. So they're building a very strong case that transmutation can occur under non-thermonuclear conditions.
What we know in medicine, that zinc is not zinc. Only very few or very new or whatever zinc atoms are used for as spark plugs for these enzymes. What we know is already we do in our particular research, but also in men, you cannot fill in the calcium deficit in the chicken lacking calcium by calcium. It has to be silicium plus oxygen. Especially flying birds, they make all their calcium depending out of silicium. It was found in Alaska bacteria manufacturing gold out of tritium and mercury.
Alchemical bacteria.
Who put that oil? Is it just all one dinosaur, the oil down there? Another thing is very important now, and this is what just I wanted, I mean, made some research on this. Also in men, someone who has osteoporosis, calcium deficit, established calcium deficit, you cannot fill in this calcium deficit by using calcium. You have to use silicium. Or in other words, apparently the organism manufactures his own calcium, brand new. And it disregards the conventional calcium which is in food.
By a biochemical process, with metabolic process.
40 to 90 kilovolts per centimeter in the membranes. Enough energy. To explain this, it's in the membranes. It's isotope extinguishing, Chernobyl, Hiroshima, all these things, questions over questions. Now, very important is what we have shown is if bone metabolism would depend on food, we would decompose. We would, our fatty deposits are dependent from carbohydrates, from fat. Imagine your bone metabolism or bone structure would be dependent from calcium you take in. You would deform immediately. So the organism, by this transmutation, has a valve to regulate its growth. All is all field physics. I will show today, after more, I will show more about this. Isn't this fascinating?
Yes, it is. One question on the strontium. Does that suggest that if we're smart enough, perhaps we will be able to harness the ZPE to clear strontium 90, et cetera, from radiation victims?
In principle, I think.
In principle.
Yes. What about Mikko says?
There is some work, I don't know it well, by Brown.
Yule Brown, yes, that's the same, yeah.
Where he apparently at least claims to denature radioactive substances by special laws.
Up to 96%, I have read.
Yeah,
I want to say a few words. I'm not really a part of this, you know.
You're very much a part of it.
I don't know. After this book came out about my work in the United States, sold in 18 million, I was contacted by two very important people, among them very many others, and one of them was Nikola Tesla's grandson, and he had a safe in California with a lot of unpublished documents from his father, and he said, I think you're the one who can solve this problem, and it's very difficult to read his handwriting, somewhere in Yugoslavic and some in American. But his handwriting, it was in his next last year, he was very sick.
Right.
And I think his father was murdered. They found him in San Francisco, in a hotel. So he gave me all these documents, and from these documents I found out a lot of things. that is mentioned in the book, I think we're talking about the same thing. I call it the universal magnetic field. And at the same time, I was approached by a woman called Margaret Sanders. She was the daughter of somebody called Colonel Sanders Fried Chicken. You heard of it?
Oh, yes.
She was daughter of Colonel Sanders. And she said, I spent many years with Dr. Einstein. We were neighbors in Palm Springs. And just before he died, he gave me this formula of the unified field theory. And I think you can use it, but you have to be very careful when you publish it. So it's because Dr. Einstein would not like to see from his heaven that it will be used for war machines, as I told you. So these are things I'm puzzling a little when so I have something written down and some pictures. So in the end of the symposium I will talk about it. And I will give you a little challenge. There's a pencil work here. I think the universal magnetic field is used in our body is a chemical battery, right? We eat some stuff and we drink something and we produce energy, electric energy, plus minus. But a chemical battery can only produce DC power, right?
That's right.
Right. But our brain and our heart are working with AC power. Can you explain that to me? Good question. Where is that converter coming from that is producing the AC power to our brain and to our heart when the body is only producing DC power?
Yeah, very easy. You just ask Dr. Lawrence to me in Stockholm.
Yeah.
Tell you.
Yeah. But I think it's universal magnetic field. It contains something I will tell you tomorrow. Or on Sunday.
Do you know how long the zephyrs in the body are altogether? About 20,000 miles. Do you think that you have a Cummins diesel in here to push on the basis of common hydrodynamics or blood dynamics or the blood through those many ramifications? It is like a magnetic railway, friction of running friction free. And for this is required a high condenser capacitance of all those members of our body, otherwise we wouldn't have a field. So we have to maintain this. All this is vacuum field physics. You cannot be a modern doctor, if this is cancer, whatever. You cannot be a modern doctor anymore without being a field physicist. Mm-hmm. Can your doctor stay home, please?
Right. Certainly, there are plenty of Casimir instructions.
We have shown, I will also see this show, that with the repair or the increase of the cell membrane capacitance, we avoid all kinds of integrity, of integrity, including cancer. There's absolutely no colon cancer recurrence in calcium APs given.
Really?
At zero, wipes out. I showed this now for the first time.
Have you any
later.
Suggestion of the mechanism of action?
The condenser function of the cell membrane is increased dramatically, as in a child. We have absolutely no after effects in chronic diabetes. That's so a lady, now 40 years old, since 25 years. Diabetes 1, she was becoming blind, getting blind.
Retinopathy.
20 years ago, she's completely free from any disturbance. Of these, I have hundreds, I have seen 1,000 MS patients talking about this. The buildup of bone is osteoporosis. Is a piezoelectrodynamic phenomenon and not a biochemical. You can touch what you want. We are a tremendous electrodynamic membrane-mediated machine.
Yeah. But where comes the AC
huh?
power from?
Huh?
Where comes the AC frequency?
As Dr. Nordenstrain, he knows better than the entire book, apparently we regenerate this electrical power from the pumping. Dr. Nordstrom says that with every beat of heart, there's a tremendous wave of magnetic force going through the entire organism, which pumps, because when you stand upside down, you stand here.
Yeah.
The blood pressure is the same.
Yeah.
It's the same as down here. How is this done? By your heart here?
Yes.
It would collapse. These are electrodynamic
waves.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So Dr. Yonor, there's physical and physical mechanism also in the circulatory system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole body is a magnetic
system. Yeah. Yeah. When this field is collapsing, you get a heart attack because everything gets arrested, or with under the effect of lactic acid. When this field is kept well, there is no heart attack anymore. With this, we rejuvenate our system, our structure, by just keeping alive the electromagnetic forces in functioning of cell membranes. Everything else is automatically dependent therefrom. Our gene system is not connected by Borden's glue, it's magnetic forces, is there?
But the heart cannot pump intelligence into your brain. The intelligence is waves.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Can I ask you my question?
Yeah, sure.
First of all, I would ask you to comment, Dr. Nipa's statement about the impression, moving body, time. Limited impression, as if I understood you correctly.
What the
you said something about the 8 hours limited the impression.
When you do a
I misunderstood you.
The phantom, you have a leaf, you can have a piece. And this takes in place for about 8 hours. This is the interesting discussion. This energy stays in place more or less, not moving or very slowly. Apparently, is not that compartment which accounts for gravitational acceleration or shielding effect or speed of light or whatever. So the energy which produces a shielding effect, supposedly, or gravitational shielding effect, is only a very, very small compartment of the energy field, you see.
So what I really wanted to ask you, or you help, if I may, could you help, is what sort of, if you I'm thinking about the qualitative aspects of this energy. What way would you think if you wanted to study the qualitative aspects? Obviously, it has some qualitative aspects of this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. What thought instrument would you have? How would you approach if you want to look at what?
To visualize, in other words?
Not just to visualize, but
you conceptualize.
Yes. You can image this kind of energy. There's various means where it produces photoelectronic or photoelectric energy which you can image. This is well known.
I've made hundreds of Kirlian photography myself. I did it 10 years ago. Yeah. But I would like to know what our physicist thinks about it.
The vacuum energy, by and large, in a physicist's view, is random. And so then, if you have some kind of interaction that's, you might say, meaningful, it's because there's some coherence introduced in the otherwise random field. And, I mean, in a way, the Casimir effect is just that the random field interacting with the random electron motion in the metal ends up producing a coherent interference pattern that gives this change in the field distribution. So the thing to look for is anything which turns randomness into coherence. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, any physical object interacts with the vacuum fields and produces some coherent interaction. As I mentioned, the van der Waals forces and so on. So what I would look for, I'd want to use something like quantum detectors, and the main thing I would be interested in measuring would be coherence. Now, okay, well, for example, I know of Fritz Popp's work in Germany on biophoton emission. And he's collected data to show that the light that's emitted by biological organisms is coherently organized. And so, I mean, unlike Kirlian photography, where you apply an electrical discharge field and get some effect, he's talking about the natural radiation that comes off biological organisms. So there's a case where if the fields are coherent, and he claims that they are, that might be a signature of this qualitative interaction.
Would some luminescence be another indication?
Yeah, certainly it's basically kind of an artificial situation, but it is.
if you had an array of quantum detectors, but right now it's I don't know exactly how you would do that. That would be what I would look for. In other words, I would look for the fact that something happening here was coherently happening over here as well. So these two things, even though they might individually look very random, you'd find that the that they were correlated. So that's where I would look for the qualitative aspects, not in the energy density specifically, but in the correlations. And so I know you might use Josen junction detectors or something. You would need quantum detectors. So I don't know of an easy way.
It's necessary. I don't have the scientific thing, but I just try to imagine a sort of amateur scientist.
Right.
I'm at that level.
That's why I think like the biophoton emission, where it's occurring naturally in organisms, might be the first place to look. And in fact, Fritz Popp is now building a whole body biophoton chamber where a person can go and stand inside the chamber, and it measures the biophoton emission from his entire body, and it's connected to a computer, and it calculates the coherence of the fields. And so that might be the first detection of, quote, the aura, in a sense. I mean, you'll actually see biophoton emission off the human body and all of its correlations. So that'll be completed this year, so that should be interesting to see.
How about infrared photography? You're not putting anything in, but you're with sensitive film, you're seeing.
Yeah, you're certainly seeing
hot spots, cold spots.
Right.
That's another way of seeing at least the biological
biological activity. Right. Question.
In the occult literature, they talk about etheric field. Are they the same, almost connected with the vacuum field?
Yeah, I've sort of speculated that maybe what's being described there in the vacuum field, or at least the the introduction of patterns into the vacuum field, may be what is attempted to be described there.
You talk about the aura. Some sensitive people, they see colors or something, feels around other people. Are they possible that they have some view, can look at this field, or what you call the coherence of the field, and see it like colors or something like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do have one startling experience along those lines, which I couldn't explain, and that was I had a woman come to my lab where we were working on lasers, and she claimed she could see auras. And she claimed she could see auras around crystals. So I had several crystals in my laboratory, because it was a laser lab, and so I asked her. They were lithium niobate, sapphire crystals, ruby laser rods, and so just as a test, I asked her to draw what she saw around these different crystals. And what was most interesting to me was that I had a very finely polished ruby laser rod, perfect cylinder, it's light pink color, very beautiful jewel-like kind of laser rod. I also had a very rough piece of sapphire material that had come out of a cave, and it couldn't have looked more different from this physically. And then she claimed that even though they looked so different physically, they had exactly the same aura. Well, in fact, a ruby laser rod is a sapphire crystal with some light chromium doping. And so even though they physically look different at the crystal structure level, they're essentially identical. And she claimed to see that they looked the same in this so-called aura. So I found that quite striking. And but I don't know how someone would do that.
Polaroid, Edward Land did a number of experiments with people at Harvard and MIT, in which we found a rather high percentage of people that could see beyond the normal visible spectrum.
in the UV slightly, in the near UV and the near infrared,
right.
Not the far spectrum, but outside of the normal visible spectrum.
Right.
I may come back to the word what you mentioned in intelligent pulling aside of plates instead of separating them again.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain phenomenon that is called in Germany the magnetic paradox. I think it was copied from Heisenberg, this published years ago. He showed that the work delivered when a magnet is approaching a metal plate or so, is more than the intelligent pulling aside of this plate.
Hmm.
So there's a differential.
I see. I hadn't seen that. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Do you
electromagnetic and magnetic, both.
Do you know of a write-up on this? I'd like to see.
I have it deep in my basement.
Right.
Right. I do not know if I will find it, but it's the same thing what you just had mentioned.
Hmm.
Fundamentally.
Yes.
Once you are talking about crystals, something strange happened to me. I became a very good friend of a Swedish scientist named Henry Kjellson, and he spent 4 years of research and development on the Great Pyramid of Giza, and he translated 20,000 pages of the Mahabharata, and he was a very good friend of Dalai Lama. And Dalai Lama sent me in Hawaii, his highest priest, to teach me how to see auras. He said, it's for your protection. And he said, the highest priest, Lama Tenzin, and the Dalai Lama, he was teaching me for a whole month. And then Dr. Kjellson, he was part of the group who was excavating in Egypt in the 20s, Tutankhamun's tomb and thing. And they were in the temple of Dendur in Luxor. And in the entire temple, it's a really huge temple, big, deep down in granite. And in the biggest hall, there was only one stone in the floor that he lifted, and on the bottom it was a gold box, and this gold box was 3 huge crystals. And before he died, he gave these huge crystals to me. And it's so powerful that the holy kahunas in Hawaii not holding the crystals here. And there are 3 of them, and I was told to put them on 3 places on Earth. And they have they're extremely powerful.
Yeah, as you will see in my brochures, one is a research photograph by Lyons, friend of mine, in the Caucasian Mountains, where these people have tremendous gravitational attractions. Not only for metal, but also for plastic and wood. But you didn't read my pyramid research article.
Well, I haven't.
You did pyramid research.
So
you
did. Yes, I do.
Sure. very simple. It was very well accepted. What I found, I just went to the pyramid, and not to Chesson, but to the Chevron pyramid, and there you see waves of pattern, wavy pattern all over the stones. And it was evident that all these stones were cut by a melting process.
Yeah.
Over the stones. This one. And I gave it to the Egyptian Institute, and also a patient of mine in Berlin, and they are doing a course. As a matter of fact, there is sinter crust of that. So there is a technology where the stone was melted, can only be laser, cracking, this kind of energy.
And they get it so close together.
And you know from the psyche research that in a beam, in the solenoid beam of the psyche device, you turn to fumes a stone, with the exception of mica, in a cold state. It just the atomic dimensions may vary. It decomposes to fumes without that heat is involved.
The interesting of these 3 crystals is that they are the long cut of the pyramid. And they are handmade. I have an expert of crystals, Bruce Cathy from New Zealand, who was examining these crystals. And he said to me, I cannot figure out that these can be handmade of any man on earth.
I disputed this. Is there a theory that there were primitive people, but thousands of people on roads and lambs and so forth? Forget about.
Yeah.
You can also on a block of 16 tons, you have only 10 people or 20 to push it. If you have 100,000, it wouldn't help.
No.
So either it's conventional or it's some technology from
beyond our imagination, and into the letter.
Because the pyramid consists of over 2,400,000 blocks of stone, and each of them weigh more than 12 tons.
And they were built in 30 years.
But if you take down one block every 10 minutes today, which you cannot do with our present technology, it will take you 64 years to take it down. Yeah. It's easier to take it down than to build it.
I showed that the platform, the Chatham Pyramid, is on. They harvested with cutting like piece of bread or like with a knife with a cheese. They harvested. Was this paper ever published in English or translated into English? When you come to Hanover, I make you a copy.
Okay,
with your photos.
You may recall this. Didn't Professor Alvarez at Berkeley, when he was looking at for ways to measure cosmic waves, he conducted a number of recording experiments within the pyramid at Giza. And as I was told, he got some very strange recordings. He did find his cosmic particles all right, just fine. It proved the cosmic wind, but as I understand,
there was some anomaly.
There were some tapes, and every time the tapes were replayed, he got slightly different results.
Yeah.
I don't know.
My friend, Dr. Chelson, he revealed 1967 for that. There was a secret chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I have the picture of a drawing of the secret chamber, where it's located exactly. In 1987, in October, French archaeologists dig them to the wall with these pneumatic drills and ruin a big part. And after that, everything is secret. You can't get any information what they found, but they found the chamber.
Well, that's
exactly
what I
also
heard.
Yeah.
May
I
ask a question?
Yeah. I heard
since we're getting away from the subject, I just want to ask a similar question. I read the other day about the earlier space flights. One astronaut about 100 kilometers distance from the surface of the Earth observed the phenomena, sun up and sun down, that since you mentioned Cathy, looked like giant arcs of light from the center of the Earth. And it was a phenomenon he photographed and documented. And if it is real, which I do not know, it would fit very nicely in this Cathy's ideas about the energy or system or whatever it is, some sort of grid system. Could you comment this?
I haven't heard about that.
Crystals always have a frequency.
It's the so-called air glow, which is when you come to Huntsville, people Müller, the German people with NASA showed it. There is a glow when the space lab goes through the field. There is a glow on the front side of the spacecraft, which is produced by something other than air.
No, but this was not this was not a phenomenon. It's clearly how to say it. And I'm fighting with the language. It was clearly bottled. It was like a giant reflector. It was giant reflectors.
Like a physical reflector,
that's something a physical
was reflecting the light.
Yes.
It was as though there was something there. Yeah.
It was not one. It was a grid of them.
Look, there are turbulence in the vacuum field. This is what we call geopathogenic zones. You can see this in my book. This was tested and analyzed with a Cray computer in Los Alamos. And when people stay in this, their system decharges, they get cardiovascular, cancer, etc. So we are not in safety everywhere. These are spill turbulence is in the field. They are harmful.
Could I say something? When you got out, almost out of the vacuum field, the last reading we did was about UFO. We interview people who have contact with and so on, believe it or not. But one of the contact people talked about this kind of energy. and it put together that was some kind of energy between the atoms or something like that, because she couldn't explain it. When I now read that you come to town and talk about the bottom field, I recognize all the explained part of the energy they use. And she also told about this crystal and how the principle was to transport the ships between the planets and so on. So what you talk about now, exactly that they explain how this tunnels, where the time goes almost to zero between two planets, they transport these ships to Earth. And these places, they call the 6-point places. There's some kind of energy in the field. And we went out to try to find this thing. And we have found some of these places outside Stockholm. And they are connected with other planets and so on. And we found the time chamber. When the time changes, the changed energy on the places. And then we found, we used these road sticks and so on.
The inner space UFO, UFO, I can only comment as a doctor. UFOs are like gravity, either yes or no. There's not just a little.
No, but
just
like
gravity,
a little pressure. You don't have to believe it, but the interesting thing is what you are explaining now is almost exactly explain how they use the energy. And they use some vibrating crystals to release this energy. Energy is stored inside crystals. And they use it, and they give us something to build. So we build one thing with much crystals inside, and we put up some type of energy from it, but we can't measure it now. But when we put this on these places outside in nature, we can chase the whole area around. If you go with these sticks, if the place is about 10 meters around, you can change for 700 meters, and so on. But when we found something about this, and I don't understand if they have connect with UFOs or not, but they talk about this type of energy.
I
ask you about the time, because they explained about the time. They have another name for time, because they can change time inside these fields.
Right.
That's
compatible with general relativity.
Yes, yeah, and sure. They change time. When they change time, they can transport themselves 7 light years in a few seconds. And they materialize themselves here and when they come down.
Yeah.
And then you can use several other things, but I can't explain that how it goes. But we found places. We don't find the UFOs, of course, but we found the places how they have pointed out for us on the map. There you find this place and we found it. And it's a very interesting thing if they have some connection.
Yeah. With respect to place, right, we have one definite proof, and this I was confronted with when I was here, various hearings in the United States Senate. This is the so-called Epsilon Boötes probe. Did you ever hear of this?
Yeah, sure.
Epsilon Boötes probe is an automat machine which goes around the Earth in a largely elliptic lunar elliptic orbit. Was first detected by radio amateurs in 1928, and the signals received from before space travel from here, and the signals received were always the multiple entities of running time or so. I recall. Well, anyway, this pattern was deciphered by the British Secret Service. I have the documents at home, and the conclusion was that this machine comes from the star Epsilon Boötes, which is 8 light years. This was the conclusion. This was written up, I think, in space.
It's as though it was an artificial satellite that was put into orbit around the Earth by some other system.
Yeah, an automatic machine. And this was again close in 1973. And there was then the question, shall Apollo ships be, there are still 3 or 4 now in the garage now, so shall Apollo ships be used to catch that satellite?
But it was not possible because there is, of course, no catching mess like for the moon to go back, to go there and bring it back again. But the Epsilon Boeotis probe, there is absolutely no doubt about, and this is an automatic machine which is not from this Earth, very unlikely. This is documented.
Sighted it in telescopes, or
no? I think it was never seen, so for optically only by registration. I have the documents at home. I can show it to you.
Okay.
This is I mean, all attempts by NASA. That's why they retained 3 or 4 Apollo ships. Not feasible. Very interesting. And the other thing is what I have published on the pyramids, and it should be translated in English. There's absolutely no doubt that the pyramid blocks were cut by a melting, by a high technology melting procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fuming, put for fumes in the stone structure.
But they use the form where we got this schematic and build this thing. It's a pyramid on the top and it's a long cone inside and so on. We have to put it together. But we don't understand how it works. And maybe it has some connection. It could disturb this thing in some way. Because it disturbs these rocks.
When the pyramid effect, you can buy this as so-called Tesla plates in Germany. You keep this into a pool which is dirty or with algae and the entire water cleans. You know this. I have this system in Germany. I have the cassette. I don't have it here. Questions over questions over questions.
Yes.
You only give the information. You know this. The Blocher system. How can this be explained? We do not know. The feces from cows, all this decomposes to a non-smelling material within a very short time. Questions over questions. All this has to do with field physics.
In the notes of Nikola Tesla, again and again, it's mentioned that the speed of the magnetic field is indefinite. So that the speed of light is not the fastest speed in the universe. So the speed of the magnetic field is, what do you call it, indefinite?
Infinite.
So the once you start the frequency in the magnetic field here now, it's immediate in the entire universe, the same moment. That might be.
Coy says the same. I have the Coy books from Phillips at home. You know Coy.
Kooi. Kooi. Dutch
physicist.
With Phillips.
I have the books.
With my iMac. We wanted to make some experiments with these big crystals, and Bruce Cathy was with us in Hawaii, near by the space laboratory and the observatory
up in Hawaii.
Yeah, so we cut this tree, and first we used a normal laser, and we just had a beautiful color spectrum, and then we put a 5 kilowatt power laser into it, and we had like an explosion. Everybody was blinded.
Really?
Of light around the area, and all the electric circuits in the area of several kilometers completely.
So there was
all the fuses.
A magnetic release, interaction.
Yeah. An enormous magnetic field that we could not control.
Okay.
That's definitely.
Okay. Thank you. I think we should stop for now. And maybe we can continue to talk at the dinner. I think you're hungry. Anyway, thank you very much. And thank you for attending the press conference. I really feel sorry for the press.
They wouldn't have
they are missing.
They wouldn't have anything.